The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The cover drawing this week shows Russian President Vladimir Putin in the foreground. He's got an angry look on his face, and he's ripping into a Ukrainian flag. In the background, sitting in a chair and tied to a chair with a just kind of a despondent look on his face is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The headline is Erasing Ukraine, Putin's Unhinged Attempt to Reverse the Fall of the Soviet Union. And a lot has happened since the magazine was published, or this issue was published, but we'll start with that as our first main story. Putin's assault on Ukraine and history. What happened? Ukraine braced for war this week after Russian President Vladimir Putin sent troops into separatist-held areas in the country's eastern Donbass region and declared Donetsk and Luhansk regions were now independent republics. This is the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, said President Biden. Putin's action came after an emotional televised speech in which he claimed that Ukraine was created by Russia and remains an inalienable part of it, but has become a colony of the West. He accused Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky of running a corrupt puppet regime hostile to Moscow and asserted Russia's right to take retaliatory measures to ensure its own security. Ukraine's parliament declared a state of emergency as the country was hit with a wave of cyber attacks and Russia's 190,000 troops moved into battle position on Ukraine's borders. The Russian parliament approved the use of military force abroad, and Putin issued Kyiv a set of demands. He said Ukraine must recognize Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014, as Russian territory, declare it will never join NATO, and relinquish advanced weapons supplied by the West. Biden called Russian troop movements into eastern Ukraine a flagrant violation of international law and announced a round of sanctions. The measures froze the assets of two Russian banks and cut off the Russian government's access to new U.S. financing. European leaders imposed similar sanctions, and Germany halted certification of the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 pipeline, built to carry natural gas from Russia to Europe. Some Republicans criticized Biden for not immediately unleashing the full arsenal of U.S. sanctions, but Biden said he was holding some in reserve and vowed to turn up the heat if Russia goes further. Zelensky called up military reservists, and some citizens vowed to take up arms to defend against an attack. We will do anything to rescue Ukraine, said Maria Skoropad, a 20-year-old law student. Zelensky urged Ukrainians to keep a cool head and prepare to fight. We are on our own land, he said. We are not afraid of anything or anyone. What the editorial said. This is the way the post-war world ends, said the Washington Post, with a rant. In his extraordinary soliloquy, Putin declared illegitimate not only a sovereign Ukraine, but the entire security architecture that's maintained peace in post-war Europe. It was an unmistakable attempt to justify a war to the Russian people, though it obscured the real reason Putin has Ukraine in his sights, to maintain his grip on power, which would be threatened by a successful democratic experiment on Russia's border. The new Cold War has arrived, said the Wall Street Journal, and Biden needs to meet the challenge. The White House hopes holding back on sanctions might forestall an assault on Kyiv, But Putin responds only to strength. Sanctions should be leveraged against all Russian banks and dozens of Russian oligarchs stashing their wealth abroad. For years, a complacent West has erred by treating Putin like a reasonable geopolitical partner. But he's made clear he doesn't want a place in the international order. He wants to blow it up. What the columnist said. If Russia launches a swift, brutal blitzkrieg to take Kyiv, the results could be catastrophic, said Jonah Shep in New York Magazine. U.S. analysts predict more than 50,000 could be killed, with up to 5 million refugees fleeing Ukraine. But a drawn-out Russian occupation will trigger fierce guerrilla resistance by Ukrainians and could become a politically disastrous quagmire for Putin. If he's still rational, he might settle for annexing Donetsk and Luhansk the way he did Crimea in 2014, which could still meet his goal of destabilizing Ukraine politically and undermining Zelensky. Putin's rationality is in question, said Anton Chernovsky in the New York Times. His isolation during the pandemic, which he's spent ensconced in a virus-free cocoon, more isolated than ever, has left him more paranoid, more aggrieved, and more reckless. A full-on invasion of Ukraine, analysts agree, would not be in Putin's interest, but is he too obsessed with the long-standing grievances to realize that? His unhinged speech suggests he is not as stable as we would hope, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Putin made clear that he refuses to accept losing the Cold War and that none of the new states that emerged from the Soviet collapse are real countries. It's now clear that this will be his forever war and Russia will be fighting it as long as he remains in power. We are all Ukrainians now, said Max Boot in The Washington Post. As Putin pursues his fantasy of rebuilding Russia's lost empire, Ukrainian resistance is the only thing holding back a lawless new phase of world history. That means their fight is our fight, too. If Putin prevails in erasing Ukraine, we would be entering a dangerous new world where dictatorships hold sway and democracies cower. A brief note, we are having some technical difficulty with the soundboard, and so those of you who are accustomed to hearing a familiar tune between segments and at the beginning and end of the show, that will not be part of it today, and we will just read the magazine. That brings us to the controversy of the week. School board recalls, a warning for Democrats. San Francisco experienced a moderate earthquake last week, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, and the seismic waves spreading across the nation could portend a bigger quake in November. In a citywide special election, more than 70% of citizens in that liberal bastion voted to recall three ultra-progressive members of the city school board for putting their woke obsessions ahead of the children's education. The ousted members, Allison Collins, Gabriela Lopez, and Fauga Moliga, belong to a board that, faced with the unfolding disaster of remote learning, kept schools closed for most of 2020 and much of 2021, focusing instead on renaming 44 local schools to expunge the legacies of such notorious white supremacists as Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Dianne Feinstein. Many parents were also enraged that the board scrapped merit-based admissions at elite Lowell High School, installing a lottery system with the explicit goal of reducing the number of white and Asian students. San Francisco's far left is defiant, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner, blaming the recalls on the racism of closet Republicans, a dubious claim in a city that gave Joe Biden 85% of its vote. Along with Governor Glenn Youngkin's upset victory in Virginia last year, these recalls were part of a wider revolt against wokeism that in the 2022 elections may see Democrats swept from power nationwide. Sorry, but this was a plea for basic competence, not a rejection of progressive politics, said the San Francisco Chronicle in an editorial. Most parents support refusal to reopen schools, even when COVID cases numbers fell, made those gaps markedly worse for Black and Latino students. The recall campaign drew much of its energy from Asian Americans who came out in force, said J. Caspian Kang in the New York Times. They were understandably upset by changes in admission criteria at Lowell aimed at their children, and their anger deepened when activists dug up Allison Collins' old tweets calling Asians house blanks, N-word, who rely on white supremacist thinking to assimilate and get ahead. The school board richly deserved this rebuke, but it hardly portends catastrophe for Democrats on a national level. You may be whistling past the graveyard, said Gary Camilla in the Atlantic. Yes, San Francisco's school board angered parents with its maximalist position on closing schools, but polls show that school closures nationwide are associated with Democrats, so that's hardly cause for progressive relief. As for the board's symbolic excesses in the name of racial equity, they were very much rooted in the anti-racism beliefs in vogue among progressive teachers and administrators in many cities and states. From Virginia to San Francisco, a full-blown parents' movement is gaining momentum, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, and it's going to make a difference in our politics. San Francisco's recall was a victory for reason over radicalism, said David French in the Atlantic, and let's hope it becomes bipartisan and widespread. Both sides of our political culture are now ruled by radical wings who wield threats and insults, such as racist and woke, to try to bully moderate, commonsensical voices into silence. Polls indicate that as many as two-thirds of Americans are disgusted with the extremism in all its forms. This exhausted majority, if it chooses to mobilize, has the numbers and the latent power to transform American politics. It was a good week for cheap eats after a new survey found that 39% of pet owners admit to having sampled their pet's food before serving it to them, with 29% saying it tasted surprisingly good. It was a good week for normalcy when Carex, the Malaysian firm that produces 20% of the world's condoms, informed shareholders that it expects to see a sharp growth in sales this year as societies begin to adapt to post-pandemic life. And it was a good week for introverts after a new British study of 17,000 kids ages 8 to 18 found that one-third actually reported feeling happier during the pandemic. They got more sleep and exercise, suffered less bullying, and because of online friendships, felt less lonely. But it was a bad week for useful idiocy. After former President Trump lavished praise on Vladimir Putin for his genius seizure of eastern Ukraine, calling the Russian autocrat very savvy and boasting, "I know him very, very, very well." It was a bad week for consenting adults after all three Republican candidates to be Michigan's attorney general expressed opposition to Griswold versus Connecticut, the 1965 Supreme Court decision guaranteeing a married couple's right to use contraception. The candidates agreed that banning birth control is a state's rights issue. And it was a bad week for extremities after Finnish skier Remy Lindholm suffered a frozen penis during the men's Olympic cross-country event held in howling icy winds. Lindholm, who needed to apply a heat pack after the race, said the pain was unbearable. In other news, a short piece here, Biden halts new drilling on U.S. land. The Biden administration last week put a freeze on decisions about federal oil and gas drilling leases after 10 GOP-led states persuaded a Louisiana federal judge to block the federal government from assessing the social cost of climate change. That metric, which includes the impact of extreme weather brought on by burning fossil fuels, influences everything from pollution regulations to infrastructure spending. But Judge James D. Kane Jr., a Trump appointee, said these calculations artificially increase the cost estimates of oil and gas drilling. The Biden administration plans to appeal. For now, the administration is delaying the sale of all oil and gas leases, including an anticipated sale of drilling rights on 179,000 acres in Wyoming. The briefing this week is titled, "The Next Generation of Vaccines. How are vaccine researchers and developers responding to COVID-19's evolution? Are COVID vaccines working?" Yes, amazingly well. The vaccines have remained highly effective in preventing serious illness and death, despite the evolution of the coronavirus into more infectious, immunity-evading new variants. British data indicate that the risk of death between last July and December was 81% lower for people who had two doses of a COVID vaccine, including Pfizer's and Moderna's shots, and 93% lower for those who received a third. An unvaccinated adult is 68 times more likely to die from COVID than a boosted one. But the Omicron variant, which has more than 30 mutations in its spike proteins, has rendered vaccines less effective at preventing breakthrough infections. And recent evidence suggests boosters' protections against symptomatic infection wane after 10 weeks. The subvariant BA2 is now spreading in at least 10 countries in Europe and Asia, and new variants are likely to emerge after that, especially since under-vaccinated communities help incubate new mutations. What about boosters? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends them for all adults, and in January it approved a fourth dose for people with severely weakened immune systems. Scientists are studying emerging data on the effectiveness of another booster, and the Food and Drug Administration said this week it is possible one will be recommended in the fall, at least for people over 65. Moderna and Pfizer are both developing Omicron-tailored vaccines, and Pfizer initially predicted its version would be available in March. But production has hit delays, and with one University of Washington model suggesting that 73% of Americans have some immunity to Omicron, it might not be necessary to target that variant alone, or to play catch-up with those that follow. It takes 4 to 6 months to get new batches of variant-specific vaccines ready for distribution, and new variants can spread much more quickly. Relying on new boosters every time we have a new variant of concern, said MIT immunologist Padmini Pillai, is not a viable strategy. What would work better? Vaccine developers are now taking a variety of approaches to outpace viral evolution. The Holy Grail would be a pan-coronavirus vaccine, which would protect recipients against all forms of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, and possibly even against all beta coronaviruses. That means it could fight highly deadly viruses such as SARS-CoV-1, the virus that caused the 2003 worldwide SARS outbreak, and MERS, as well as the four viruses that cause a quarter of all common colds. In December, scientists at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research announced that their vaccine produced neutralizing antibodies against COVID and SARS in monkey. That research team recently completed the first phase of testing on humans. Other researchers are searching for a conserved site, a common feature that coronaviruses keep throughout their mutations, that could be targeted by a universal vaccine. Researchers at Duke have isolated an antibody that binds to both SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2. How likely are such vaccines? Many hurdles remain, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, has warned that they will take years to develop. The Norway-based Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations has allocated $200 million for pan-coronavirus research and aims to see one distributed by 2024 or 2025. But the supply chain for vials and other vaccine equipment is under unprecedented strain, with many manufacturers prioritizing supplies for already existing vaccines over experimental ones. And because most people now have at least some immunity via vaccines, previous infection, or both, it has become much harder for researchers to find people with no previous exposure to serve as control subjects. What can be done in the meantime? Developed countries will continue to promote boosters. Only 28% of the U.S. population has had one. Pfizer Chief Executive Albert Bourla said in January that he hopes to develop once-a-year boosters. But other experts disagree on how frequently they will be needed or if three shots will provide lasting protection against serious illness. With under 11% of people in low-income countries even partially vaccinated, the World Health Organization and many virologists are urging governments and drug makers to focus on vaccinating the rest of the world. The U.S. and other G7 nations have fallen short of the 1.4 billion vaccines they pledged to donate by 2022, but some vaccine innovators are trying to fill the gap. Novavax and Corbevax recently produced inexpensive vaccines that rely on recombinant protein technology to mimic spike proteins. These vaccines can be stored in regular refrigerators instead of the super cold storage required for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, making them more easily distributed in poor, remote areas. The developers of Corbevax, Drs. Maria Elena Botazzi and Peter Hotez of Texas Baylor College of Medicine, were funded by $7 million in private philanthropy and are not patenting their vaccine. They are working with an Indian firm to produce 1 billion shots for developing nations. Global vaccine equity, they wrote in a recent Scientific American article, is the only thing that can bring the COVID pandemic to an end. A vaccine in a nasal spray. Not all 330-plus COVID vaccines currently in development are shots. Injected vaccines generate antibodies in the blood, but don't provide much protection in the nose, which is the virus' most common entryway. So scientists are working on vaccines that can be sprayed into the nose. At least 12 such vaccines are currently in development, with one produced by India's Bharat Biotech already in a Phase 3 trial. Nasal COVID vaccines would target the source of most infections, allow patients to self-administer, and make for an attractive alternative for those who fear needles, including children. Yale immunologist Akiko Iwasaki, who led a study on nasal vaccines, predicts they'll be most useful as boosters for vaccinated people. Then you can leverage the existing immunity, she said. It's really like putting the guard outside the door as opposed to inside the door. If effective nasal vaccines can be developed and widely adopted, scientists say, it could dramatically reduce transmission and bring the pandemic to an end. This is the last word, our feature article. Title this week is Pregnant and Sick with COVID. Diana Crouch was 20 weeks along and unvaccinated when she fell seriously ill, said Ariana Onjung Cha in the Washington Post. Doctors worked for 139 days to save her and the baby she carried. Kingwood, Texas. Chris Crouch had low expectations for online dating. He was a police officer in his 30s, almost a year out from a painful divorce, and, he said, the women he had met had been playing games in ways that left him dispirited. Diana Garcia Martinez was 24 and a busy single mom whose sister had set up her profile without her knowing. She was intelligent, empathetic, and upfront, And by the third date, he was in love. It was just a feeling. I felt like I knew her my whole life, he recalled explaining to his cousin Gilbert, knowing it was a cliche, but also true. Now, 4 years later, he was in a hospital intensive care room, remembering their courtship as his wife lay unconscious, hooked up to a tangle of machines keeping her alive. Diana was 20 weeks pregnant, and he had a decision to make. If doctors delivered the baby now, they told him, she would have the best shot at surviving, but the baby was so premature that it would almost certainly die. If Chris waited, he could lose them both. Chris and Diana were married in the summer of 2019 in a small garden ceremony, and life had been pretty close to perfect since then. They were opposites, but in ways that complemented each other. Born in Monterey, Mexico, and raised in North Carolina, Diana was quiet and tended to choose her words carefully. He was a gregarious Texan with a quirky way of recalling dates, numbers, and interesting facts about everything from football to legal statutes, a habit that sparked lively conversations with strangers wherever they went. They agreed on conservative values. He was raised Baptist and she was Catholic, and they shared a sharp sense of humor, enjoying shows like The Office together. They had a boy, Kane, and Chris was promoted to sergeant at the Harris County Sheriff's Office, a job that provided a steady enough income that Diana could stay home and take care of their blended family. He had two boys from his previous marriage. She had a girl from hers. The family was young, healthy, and happy. And when the pandemic hit, they were worried like everyone else. Before long, though, they started feeling the dangers of the virus had been exaggerated, and they wanted to get back to their lives. When the vaccines came along, Chris became outspoken against them, espousing views that were common in his workplace and much of Texas. But that put him at odds with his mother, sister, and the close friends who had grown up with him in the Heights, a liberal bastion in Houston. Despite his family's pleading, Chris and Diana were adamant that they did not need to be vaccinated. They did wear masks, but only when required. Chris felt vaccine mandates infringed on personal liberties, and he and Diana also worried that the shots had been developed too quickly. As Chris liked to say, God gave us our immune system, and we could fight the viruses with our own immune system. Diana, meanwhile, was leery of anything that might hurt the developing baby she carried. She knew that early stories linking the vaccines to miscarriage and infertility were false, but thought avoiding them was the prudent thing to do, like skipping wine, raw fish, and unpasteurized cheese. In the summer of 2021, the couple decided to go to Las Vegas to celebrate. They stayed at the Trump Hotel, walked along the strip, and caught a showing of Cirque du Soleil. Diana had a headache, but it didn't keep them from going out and having fun. As soon as they returned, however, she developed a low-grade fever and exhaustion unlike anything she had known. Late on August 6, she cried out that she was having trouble breathing. Chris called 911, reminding himself that in his line of work, he'd seen a lot of people go to the hospital for COVID, with most recovering fine after a little oxygen. Diana's case would turn out to be far less simple. The emergency doctors at the local hospital immediately transferred her to Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, which had created a special unit for pregnant women with COVID. Chris remembers Diana screaming when doctors told them she needed a ventilator. "I have kids. I can't die." He held her and made a promise he wasn't sure he could keep. "You are not going to die," he vowed. From the start, Diana's case weighed on Cameron Desfulian, a critical care specialist supervising or consulting on dozens of pregnancies. "She was unusual," he recalled. Most of his other patients had pre-existing conditions such as obesity and were close to full term at 36 to 40 weeks. Diana had been healthy, about 110 pounds, and at 18 weeks when she first arrived at the hospital, still in the second trimester of her pregnancy. She had at least a month before the fetus would be considered viable, a situation that complicated treatment options. Pregnancy does extraordinary things to the body, and the interaction of those changes with COVID is something scientists are only beginning to understand. Doctors are still baffled about why pregnant women appear to be especially likely to get seriously ill with COVID. It could be that pregnancy causes the immune system to be in a heightened state of alert to protect the baby. So when exposed to a virus, it may overreact. Another theory suggests the opposite, that pregnant women are immunosuppressed so that their bodies don't reject the developing fetuses. Fetuses also pull oxygen and blood to the placenta. When combined with a virus like COVID that can cause lung damage and blood clotting, the body's balance may be upset. Whatever the cause, Desfulian said, there is no doubt pregnancy and the coronavirus are a setup for more illness. For Chris, the next 10 days blurred together. He wasn't allowed to leave the room because he was also assumed to have coronavirus. Chris had never lost anyone close to him. And as he stared at his wife and saw her suffering, he couldn't shake the question that kept popping into his head. Was this my fault? During those long hours alone, he struggled with how strongly he had held to beliefs about the vaccines without really examining them. He began writing to friends, family, and even strangers on Facebook, urging them to get the shots. Somewhere along the way, he got vaccinated himself. When you sit there and you see your wife on life support because of COVID, you throw out politics, he said later. None of that matters anymore. Desfulian's team had hoped that the oxygen they were pumping into Diana's lungs through a ventilator would enable her to fight off the virus. Instead, things were going in the opposite direction. Every day we were losing a little bit of ground, he said. 14 days after Diana arrived at the hospital, the group concluded it was time to move Diana to another machine called ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, in which the blood is pumped outside the body to give the lungs and heart a chance to rest. The decision to put a patient on ECMO is not taken lightly. That therapy, developed in the 1970s, is life-saving in the right circumstances, but it can also lead to bleeding, stroke, seizure, blood clots, and infection. Moreover, the equipment is scarce, the staffing intensive, and the treatment can run up hospital bills into the millions. On the day his team recommended ECMO for Diana, a somber trio of staff members appeared in a room to visit Chris. He doesn't remember the exact words they used, but they seemed to speak in euphemisms. They would ask how you were, and then throw in a question like, what would he want done if his wife's heart stopped? They were giving you hints, he said. Chris was worried about putting Diana on the new machine. When he Googled ECMO, he found, it's a bad, bad deal. Using ECMO during pregnancy is extremely rare. One study from the University of North Carolina detailed what happened in 9 cases from 2008 to 2017. Only 3 of the women lived and only 5 of the babies, for a survival rate of 33% and 55% respectively. Still, Chris had decided he had to try to save both Diana and the baby. I don't know if one or the other was going to live or both were going to die, he said. I didn't know if I was going to go back home without anybody. Doctors had expected Diana to be on the machine for up to about 21 days. When that marker came and went, Chris told himself to be patient and stared at the tubes of blood swirling around his wife's body. On day 30, it seemed like their ordeal might be over. Diana woke up and was even able to get on her phone and text her family hello. Chris remembers the whole staff smiling and making plans for next steps. The happy moment was all too brief. It wasn't long before Diana started seeming confused. Soon she could no longer see, even though she was still talking to Chris. An hour later, she slipped into a coma, and the somber three walked to the room again. Diana was suffering from an embolic shower in which blood clots burst and scatter, the doctors explained. Three had gone to her brain, causing strokes, and another had lodged in a wall of her heart, resulting in a heart attack. It was a known complication of ECMO, but they had not been able to put her on blood thinners because she had a bleeding in her gastrointestinal tract and in her throat, where doctors had cut a hole for the ventilator. Now the doctors told Chris that even if Diana woke up, she might not be the same, that she might not remember him or the children. Chris crumpled into the chair next to her and wept. Desfulian came by and prayed with him. "That's when I prayed the most," Chris said, because at that point, even the doctors were like, "We don't really know what to do next." Diana went back on ECMO, and as the day slowly passed, Chris could see her belly growing. Through everything, the baby's heart rate held steady and was growing nicely. On November 10th, when Diana had been in the hospital more than 3 months and the baby was 31 weeks along, doctors delivered a baby boy by C-section. He was 4 pounds, 12 ounces. The infant was healthy, but Diana's body seemed exhausted from the ordeal. She developed an infection, an air leak in her lungs, and one eventually collapsed. Doctors began preparing for a lung transplant. It was in this dark moment that things began to shift. Without the added stress of carrying the baby, Diana's body began to repair itself. And by the end of November, doctors were able to wake her up. She was tremendously weak and at first didn't know Chris. His heart felt like it was disintegrating, but then, when a nurse told Diana he was her husband, she pointed to a picture of them on the beach that Chris had posted on the wall and said, "No, that's my husband." Slowly, against all odds, Diana's memories came back, and she began asking about her two other children and wondering how it could be that she was no longer pregnant. She asked Chris, "Why didn't anybody tell me I was going to have a C-section?" Shortly before Christmas, on December 23rd, Diana was able to return home after 139 days at the hospital, 101 on a ventilator, 51 of those also on ECMO. As soon as they arrived, Chris scooped her up and put her in a bed he and Diana's father had set up downstairs, and Kane, 1, and their daughter, Miranda, 7, piled onto the blankets. Chris cradled their newborn Cameron, plump and healthy, whom they had named after Desfulian, Diana's doctor. Physically, doctors are optimistic Diana will make a full recovery, but it will take time, and she's still weak on her left side because of the strokes. Emotionally, she's struggling. She has anxiety about seeing people and leaving her home for fear of her or her loved ones being infected with the virus. "Things I used to do before, I can't do anymore. And it's so hard for the kids, and it's hard for me because you want to do so much more. And they want you to do so much more," she said. Most of their extended family, who had resisted vaccines, has now gotten them after learning of Diana's ordeal. But a few remain reluctant. In January, they got word that Gilbert, one of Diana's favorite relatives on Chris's side, who was also unvaccinated, had COVID. He was one of the first people Chris had told about Diana, and he was always joking to Chris that he had done well for himself in finding her. He died in late January, and Diana cried all night. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The conservative humorist who skewered all sides, P.J. O'Rourke, 1947 to 2022. P.J. O'Rourke might have been the funniest conservative ever. In scores of articles and 20 books, the humorist married his caustic wit to a gonzo writing style that drew comparisons with Hunter S. Thompson. As he targeted liberal pieties, smug elitism, and hypocrisy wherever he found it. The libertarian O'Rourke opposed government spending, Kennedy kids, seatbelt laws, and jewelry on men. He wrote in Republican Party Reptile, 1995, Among his other bestsellers were Holidays in Hell, 1998, a collection of pieces about visiting war-torn countries, and Parliament of Horrors, 1991, subtitled A Lone Humorous Attempt to Explain the U.S. Government. A frequent talk show visitor, partial to Scotch cigars and pinstriped Oxfords, O'Rourke cast his aim wide, and he was quick to puncture his own team's foibles. Democrats promise government will make you smarter, taller, richer, and remove the crabgrass on your lawn, he wrote. Republicans tell you government doesn't work and then get elected to prove it. O'Rourke was born in Toledo, Ohio, where his father was a car salesman and his mother was a school administrator, said the Telegraph. He attended Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and earned a master's in English from Johns Hopkins. There, the then-hippie wrote for a rock-and-roll Marxist student journal called Harry. But the constant socialist diatribe soured him on leftism, and he ditched his bell-bottoms. He moved to New York and wrote for the humor mag National Lampoon, where he became known for raucous, politically incorrect articles, said the Washington Post. After serving as editor-in-chief from 1978 to 1980, he freelanced a bit and landed as foreign affairs chief for Rolling Stone, filing dispatches about his misadventures in the Philippines, the Soviet Union, Nicaragua, and other locales. O'Rourke evolved to be a familiar presence as a writer and on-air pundit, said the Associated Press. He did a stint on 60 Minutes in 1996 as a conservative for the Point Counterpoint segment. In later years, he was a regular panelist on the NPR News Quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. During a 2016 appearance on that show, he reluctantly declared he was voting for Hillary Clinton, asserting she was wrong about absolutely everything, but that Donald Trump must be stopped. Still, it rankled him. I mean, my whole purpose in life, basically, said, is to offend everyone who listens to NPR. A couple of articles from the Health and Science page. Another step toward a cure for HIV. A mixed-race woman, age 64 and suffering from leukemia, has become the third person to be apparently cured of HIV. The unidentified patient received a transplant of stem cells taken from a relative and from the umbilical cord of a baby with a rare genetic feature, typically seen in just a few people of European or Caucasian descent, that provides resistance to HIV. The woman had been diagnosed with the virus in 2013 and received the transplant 4 years later. Since then, her viral load has been undetectable. The previous two patients, both treated with adult stem cells only, were men, one white and one Latino. The presumed success of the umbilical cell treatment raises the hope that eventually a wider array of people can be cured, said the Washington Post. However, all three patients received their transplants as part of treatment for blood cancers. Such transplants have failed in others, and experts on medical ethics consider them too risky to be used on people with HIV who are otherwise healthy. Carlos Del Rio from Emory University School of Medicine says that while the breakthrough is critical science to eventually get us to a cure, it is not a scalable intervention for general use. This is like sending someone on a rocket to the moon, he says. It's great science, but it's not the way we're going to travel. Mega drought in the West. The mega drought currently parching the western United States is the region's driest 22-year spell in at least 1,200 years. That's the conclusion of a new study of climate in southwestern North America dating back to the year 800, said the Los Angeles Times. The researchers calculated that 42% of the current drought's severity is the result of global warming, and that these dry conditions could persist for years to come. The results are really concerning because it's showing that the drought conditions we're facing now are substantially worse because of climate change, says lead author Park Williams, a climate scientist at UCLA, noting that there is quite a bit of room for them to continue to worsen. By examining the growth rings of trees from some 1,600 different sites, Williams said his colleagues were able to compare the current dry spell to 7 megadroughts between the 800s and 1500s. He says that although the region previously yo-yoed between dry and wet periods, climate change has created a more permanent drying trend. We overlapped Neanderthals. The discovery of a child's tooth in a cave in France has revealed that early modern humans lived in Europe at least 54,000 years ago, about 10,000 years earlier than previously thought. What's more, the ancient molar and hundreds of human tools were sandwiched between layers of Neanderthal remains, showing that the two groups of hominins coexisted in the region. We've often thought that the arrival of modern humans in Europe led to the pretty rapid demise of Neanderthals, co-author Chris Stringer from the National History Museum in London tells CNN.com. But this new evidence suggests that both the appearance of modern humans in Europe and disappearance of Neanderthals is much more complex than that. The tooth was discovered in Grote Mandrin in the Rhone Valley. While the researchers have found no evidence that humans and Neanderthals shared the cave at the same time, the two groups probably encountered each other somewhere in the area, even if not in the Grote Mandrin. And we're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled Elections, Plugging a Dangerous Loophole. It's high time for Congress to amend the Electoral Count Act, the muddled 135-year-old law that governs how Congress certifies state election results, said the Dallas Morning News in an editorial. The Byzantine law passed after the disputed 1876 election is full of ambiguities that Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit in their bid to overturn his 2020 loss. And they need fixing to help prevent a rerun. There's bipartisan support for revisions, which must address several key points. First, it must be made clear that the vice president has only a ceremonial role in tallying the vote, with no right to reject the state's results, a power Trump claimed for Mike Pence in 2020. Second, currently only one senator and one House member are needed to challenge a state's slate of electors. Lawmakers should set a higher number to prevent renegade lawmakers from disrupting the count and establish a list of valid grounds for bringing an objection. The law also needs provisions for a scenario where a rogue governor sends sham electors for the losing candidate, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Republicans who back reform, however, are walking a fine line. They're trying to Trump-proof the 2024 election, but if their effort is seen by the party's base as targeting Trump, the harder it might be for 10 Senate Republicans to support it and reach the filibuster-proof 60-vote threshold. That bar may not be cleared, said Burgess Everett in Politico. A bipartisan group of 16 senators agreed that something should be done, but there's debate over how broad the effort should be, with Republicans complaining that Democrats are trying to shoehorn in election reforms unrelated to the act. My fellow conservatives must not let ECA reform die, said former federal judge J. Michael Luttig in the New York Times. Under this defective law, Congress can step in and choose the president in the event of a dispute. For a party that believes in limiting the federal government's power, it would be the height of political hypocrisy to allow Congress to overturn state election results. Trump's vow to exploit the act to seize the presidency if he runs and loses in 2024 presents a clear and present danger to our democracy, and Republicans and Democrats must put aside their partisan differences and address it. The future of our democracy depends on it. Sandy Hook, a gunmaker's $73 million payout. They were told repeatedly they couldn't win, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. But last week, families of the 9 Sandy Hook Elementary school shooting victims secured a $73 million payout from Remington Arms. 7 years before 20-year-old Adam Lanza opened fire at the Newtown, Connecticut school, a Republican-controlled Congress passed a law granting gun makers broad civil immunity from lawsuits. But the law contained a small exception for lawsuits alleging a gun's marketing violated state laws. The family's lawyers seized on that exception, citing Connecticut's Unfair Trade Practices Act, said Elizabeth Williamson in the New York Times. They argued that Remington marketed the Bushmaster XM15-E2S, one of Lanza's military-style weapons, as a way for insecure young men to reclaim their masculinity through violence. The checkmate moment was a crime scene photo of two ammunition magazines duct-taped together so that the gunman didn't have to reload, a trick used in Call of Duty, a video game Lanza compulsively played that features a shooter armed with a Bushmaster. The Mammoth settlement may not be the watershed moment gun safety advocates have been aching for, said Melissa Chan in Time. Not many states have laws such as Connecticut's, and because Remington declared bankruptcy in 2020, the payout comes from the company's 4 insurers. Gun makers without Remington's bleak financial status might prove more willing to fight. They should fight, said Brian Doherty in Reason, because the overwhelming majority of the nearly 400 million privately owned firearms in the U.S. never harm anyone at all. Manufacturers can't prevent criminals from misusing their product. Still, the makers of assault weapons now have reason to worry, said Robert Spitzer in NBCNews.com. Since 2018's Parkland, Florida shooting, major retailers such as Dick's Sporting Goods have stopped carrying them. New York enacted a law similar to Connecticut's last year, with New Jersey and California mulling similar measures. The settlement requires that the company hand over thousands of internal documents to the Sandy Hook parents, who will soon release damning details of how Remington targeted couch commandos with aggressive advertising. Consider your man card reissued, one Bushmaster ad promised. Another gloated, forces of opposition, bow down. These revelations may make other gun makers rethink their advertising campaigns and reconsider whether they want to continue in the business of making and selling assault weapons. And we'll read some of the shorter pieces. Only 13 of the 143 Republicans running for 38 congressional seats in Texas say that President Biden really beat Donald Trump in 2020. At least 42 have said that the election was stolen or that they would have voted against certifying the results. The percentage of Americans who identify as LGBTQ has doubled over the past 10 years. From 3.5% to 7.1%, a Gallup survey found. The shift is driven by younger people, with 21% of Generation Z adults, ages 18 to 25, saying they are non-heterosexual, with most identifying as bisexual. Nearly a quarter of U.S. counties gave a presidential candidate at least 80% of the vote in 2020. A huge jump from 6% of counties in 2004, according to an analysis by political scientist Larry Sabato. The trend of political self-sorting into super landslide counties appears to be accelerating as conservatives move away from places with COVID-19 mask or vaccination mandates. 73% of Americans have some immunity to the Omicron variant, either through infection or vaccination or both, according to the University of Washington's closely watched model. That number could rise to 80% by mid-March, but that still leaves about 80 million Americans with no immunity to the virus. On the poll watch, 47% of U.S. adults said that it's a very serious problem that Donald Trump reportedly took classified materials with him to Florida after leaving office, including 75% of Democrats and 16% of Republicans. 43% of adults said it was a very serious problem that Hillary Clinton used a personal email address to conduct government business while she was working as Secretary of State, including 72% of Republicans and 19% of Democrats. And we have time for a couple of quotes. The first is novelist Catherine Davis, who says, "Everybody thinks it's going to be different for them. The dinosaurs thought so too." And from Karl Popper, he says, "Our knowledge can only be finite, while our ignorance must necessarily be infinite." Something to think about. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.